Welcome to Local Voices, Local History, here on West Limerick 102 FM. I'm Shirley O'Regan and I've produced today's programme. Today's programme features Hawley Costello and Tom Dillon. Hawley is the son of Mixum Costello, who was the main character in today's programme. We will be speaking about him and speaking about the events that led to his shooting and the aftermath of his shooting and how this impacted on the Feel Fisheries dispute. The programme today, as I say, is entitled The Feel Fisheries Dispute and the Last Man Shot During the Civil War. Historian Tom Dillon contributes to the second part of today's programme, and he has researched the Feel Fisheries extensively, and he provides a wealth of information on today's programme. Hopefully you will enjoy it and appreciate it, and it is wonderful to be bringing another lesser known part of our history back to public attention once again. Hopefully you enjoy the programme and hopefully you have a great day ahead. So I am joined today, delighted to be joined today by Hawley Costello, and we've got a story for you, don't we?
We have, yeah.
We have. We're going to be talking, primarily today, we're going to be talking about Hawley's dad, Mixum Costello.
Michael Costello. Michael T, he's assigned the checks with Michael T.
Yes, and people used to know him as Mixum, wasn't
Mixum,
it?
Yeah, after a pet donkey he had.
There's always an origin for a nickname, isn't there?
So
he was called after the donkey. So I suppose many historians, or some historians at least, would argue that your dad was the last shooting of the Civil War, because he was shot on the 26th of August.
That's right.
But I suppose
the general election was on the 27th of August. And they say that's when the gun was more or less taken out of politics at that time.
Yeah, so I suppose that is the focal point of what we're talking about today. That's the reason that kind of brought us together.
Yes.
But if we might reel it back a little bit, because there's more to the story than just that incident. There is a build-up, and involvement.
Regarding my father, I just say this, as I said before, one day I was going to Tralee with him when he was an old man. And he mightn't have been the best of health at the time. He had good days and bad days and everything. But this day now, he was very bright and alert. And I asked him, I said, why did you take up arms at all? What made you do it? Well, he said it goes back to the famine. And I was surprised at that now. So he said that his stories from his father and his grandfather told about his uncles and they're going around the bank of the river, and they starved with the hunger. And what kept him alive was rabbits, catching rabbits. And the river flowed by the farm at home, and they were not allowed to take a salmon out of it. So that was a big reason that he took up the arms afterwards.
There was a residual bitterness.
But he's all right, say all right.
The people were literally starving to death on the banks of a populated river.
Fishery in the main was controlled by the landlords.
And many of whom who weren't even in the country at the time.
I suppose not. No, the landlords in question were the name Tom, but George Houston.
Houston, yes.
No, the Houstons are famous maybe for another name as well, because Bono is supposed to be the same Houston. So.
Yes.
So this is well before his time. But they had the more or less complete fishing rights.
And they had bailiffs.
And the selling rights as well.
And they had armed bailiffs on the banks of the
river. And they had armed bailiffs at an early stage. They had indeed.
Because there
was a bit of poaching. And I would say during the War of Independence and the Civil War, there was probably a lot more poaching, because the Irish were getting a foothold at this stage into the fishing.
Yes.
And just to go on from there, then there were attempts made on the life of George Houston on three separate occasions. They tried to kill him. And I think at that stage he saw the light, because there was a big court case to come up, the field fishery case. It had to do with rights of fishing, and had to do with the attempted murder of George Houston.
Sure.
My father was one of the people that was would be defending that. But before the case came up, the Houston's agent came over to my father one night, a dark night, in a Pawnee and Trap, and said, "Look," he said, "we'll give you half the selling rights of the salmon in the River Feel. We call off this." Plan to kill me.
Yes.
So my father accepted it, of course. He had the selling rights of the fishing right.
Well, half a loaf is better than the bread.
That got his foot in the door.
Yes.
Then, as regards the control of the fishing, and I think about a year or two afterwards, the Limerick Board of Fisheries took over the running of the River Shannon and the tributaries, including the Feel. Cashin. So my father was actually co-opted onto the board that time with another man down the river, Josie Dan McAuliffe, and there was another man below in Ballyduff, as far as I know. Anyway, so that got him then, they were the inside track at this stage.
Sure.
And they were they were involved in the issuing of licenses in that stage, and my father, of course, obviously gave quite a lot of to the local people around the
Snare.
And that's how the whole thing took off. Now, my father then got involved in the people that had no money, because the around Lickstan, place that was decimated after the two wars. But my father was in a position to let him go fishing, and he'd collect the money for the nets and the corks and the lead rope and the boats as they were catching the salmon.
Right.
So he did that for a good number of years, and he got a lot of people involved in the Lixna area.
So he enabled them to be self-sufficient.
For instance, in the home place at home, in the home farm, there were 30 boats fishing after a couple of years of that.
Amazing.
30. So 30. So put in three people by 30. That's 90 people.
90 people employed and
making a living out of it.
And yeah.
So that was one of the main reasons they wanted to put up a plaque for him afterwards, because he contributed in a very positive way.
He contributed in a very positive way, and he almost lost his life to contribute.
Absolutely. That's another story. Will I explain it?
on several occasions. Well, we said that he was very active during the War of Independence, wasn't he?
Oh, he was. Seemingly, he was a bit of an expert in bomb making. That was only years after we had that. He never spoke about it to us.
But you see, we were just saying there before we started recording that an awful lot of people who had kind of, if you like, secret lives, they have whole parts of their lives that they didn't talk about.
That's right.
And, you know, it's a pity. One of the reasons that we're here today is to contribute to an archive, to keep these stories.
Yeah, to make a note.
You know,
because,
I mean, if we don't remember them, they'll be gone forever.
That's right, yeah. Oh, they were brave people, no fairness.
So you never...
If you're starved with hunger, you're brave.
That's it. And if you're oppressed all of the time, like, you will eventually...
Yeah, you will.
So you discovered only later in life that your father was a bomb maker.
That's right. Yeah. And that came to light because of an incident. Maybe it was, I'd say 20 years afterwards. Some relation of his below in Bay Longford was having trouble with a neighbour over land or something, and then things were going fairly lively. So my father was calling him to know, would he come down and try and settle it?
Yes.
So he arrived down to this place in Bay Longford with a horse and car and a bomb inside in the back of the car. And he parked the car there and went away. He said, just tell him what's in that now, he said, and things might come to a head. And that settled it. There was no more problem anyway.
Well,
the bomb was never exploded, by the way.
That's one way of negotiating, isn't it?
It was.
You get what you want that way.
Yeah.
You don't have the hours of negotiating.
Yeah.
So I suppose, like, we're talking really about ordinary people living in extraordinary times, and people trying to forge a way for themselves, a fairer way for themselves and their neighbours.
Absolutely. The regime in control was very harsh altogether. Of course it was.
I mean, when we bring back to the start of our story, where there are people on the banks of a populated river full of salmon hunting for rabbits because they're starving to death.
That's right. That's a fact.
And they will be shot if they poach a salmon.
Yeah.
If they're caught.
Yeah, that was the situation.
That's the context. And that fuels the anger that we see from the likes of Mixum Costello and his brothers.
Right.
That's where the bitterness comes from. Like, it's not unfounded. It's not unreasonable.
Yeah, no, it's not unreasonable.
You know, if we found ourselves in that context, we would.
Oh, most people would. Of course they would. Yeah.
So we're, I suppose, tipping along to the focal point of our story, which is the 26th
of August. Yeah, the general election was called for the 27th on a Monday. So the 26th was a Sunday. And after Mass, it was known that there was a big rally for the Free Staters. And one of the people that was going to talk was the Minister for Fisheries.
So you can imagine that this would be fuel for the fire.
Fionnán from South Kerry.
Yes.
And of course, as I said, that's the red rag tumble to them. So they were actually the anti-treaty crowd, including my father, and they were heckling and everything. There was a speakers. There was a James Crowley. There was a James Crowley from the Stall, who was a candidate. There was a Comandant Damon Horan, who was the Free State Army officer. There was other people there as well. But when the meeting was over, anyway, one of the Free State officers came down through the crowd and picked out my father, and from point blank range shot him with a revolver through the chest. He obviously went down, and a door was procured from the dispensary across the road, and he was put on the door and brought into the dispensary. As they thought, he was unconscious, but he told me himself, he said, I could hear every word that was being said. And he had two doctors that were there saying, there's no hope for this fella. We can't do anything about it.
He would have had a gaping wound in his chest.
And by pure coincidence, a nurse that was at Mass, we found out that her name was Mary Maher. She appeared, and she had experience with the 1418 war. And she had volunteered to take over. And the doctor said, by all means, go ahead. So she performed some sort of an operation, which was basically to stop the air coming out through his lungs, because he told me that when he used to take a breath inside in the dispensary, it was only bubbles would come out to his chest.
Right.
He was on the way out. Like.
Yeah.
So she filled up the hole in his chest.
Well, I think she would have had much more experience with such
more experience,
open wounds.
Yeah, like, I think she also commented he was a strong type of man. He was only 23 years of age as well. That was commented upon as well.
There was a lot kind of going for him.
Yeah, so she saved his life.
And
we never met her or knew them until only a couple of weeks ago.
Isn't that remarkable? Because, I mean, without her actions, you wouldn't be here.
No, I wouldn't say that's for sure.
So, I mean, it's just a fate, isn't it, that she was there on that day because the two local GPs would have had no experience with open wounds like that. They wouldn't have any combat experience.
Oh, yeah, pure luck. He survived it.
Nurse Maher saved the day.
Saved the day is right. Things kind of improved afterwards. It was around that time now that I was trying to kill George Houston as well. So I think between himself and George Houston, that it's better to be together than against each other.
Yeah,
so that was about 12 months afterwards when he was recovered that Houston made the offer to give him the half the selling rights there. So they kind of walked away together after that.
Both
of them survived, tell the tale. Not so long. Houston, not so long. He died a young man.
Really?
He was really, they said he never fully recovered after the three attempts in his life.
Oh, so he was injured in the attempts?
Oh, he was left for dead on the third occasion, the bank of the river.
Yeah, so.
But he was smart enough to make up with the man across the river from him.
Well, it's easier, isn't it? It's easier to have some sort of detente than to be arguing.
Yeah, at that stage anyway, the Irish government were more in control of issuing licences and giving out all that. It was a very, the place at home was very busy after that for the selling of the salmon. There was a whole heap of salmon used to come through our yard. There was a lot of work involved with it. They had to be washed, they had to be iced, they had to be boxed. then put into crates into Horsen car and brought back to the railway station in Leixna. So there were a lot of people employed.
It was a busy place.
So
I suppose you said, I suppose this the action on the 26th of August gives a real insight into the climate at the time, like that somebody could be heckling at a rally and be shot point blank.
Yes,
yes.
You remember, this is August 23.
Yes.
There was a lot of activity in North Kerry that time.
And I suppose,
for the few months before it.
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about I just mentioned to a trade and the bombing in Knocknagoshal where 5 free sailors were killed. You had the Ballyseedy, and you had where Aero Lines and his column were wiped out in Clashmilk
and
Caves.
And you had
they were only a matter of weeks before my father was shot. So,
yeah, so
things were very volatile at that stage.
We talk nowadays about the right to protest and the right to which people have, but I mean, there wasn't much right to protest in those days,
no,
was there?
No. Get shot for heckling, like. Because they probably knew who they were.
As you said, the man walked into the crowd and singled out your father, so they would have had.
Yeah, the gun was used a lot that time.
But as
I said, from the 27th, the day after it more or less petered out, especially certainly around.
And I suppose there would be more, like we're talking about two issues really here. We're talking about the fishery issue and we're talking about the Civil War. Like you said that a lot of people within the Leixna area would have been anti-treaty because they felt that the treaty did not represent them. The treaty made no allowance for fishing rights.
Absolutely. Well, the proof of it is in that general election the following day, the man that topped the poll was Austin Stack, who was anti-treaty. And he was inside the Curragh camp.
Yes.
So there was a strong anti-treaty feeling around Leixna and North Kerry, or Kerry in general.
Yeah, because the people were just, they felt that they were not represented by it. Their needs were not met.
And there were fishing problems on the River Lown and the River Main. So it was probably just on the River Feel or the Cashin. Like, so there were big issues.
And
there was land issues as well, of course.
Yes.
There were 30 people arrested. A couple of weeks before the 26th of August in just Tanavala outside Listowel, 30 people arrested for some land agitation. They were looking for land, I think, from some landlord.
And he thinking of the context of a townland like Tanavala, 30 people would probably be the most of the people who were there.
I'd say it was. Just rounded them up and
most of the population of the townland.
I'd say so. And some of the big houses had been burned. There was a big one in Kilmorna. That was burned to the ground, and the headman Vickers, he was shot.
Okay, we came across.
And there
Vickers.
Was a big house in Ballinrothera, outside Listowel, and that was burned to the ground. And that there was a lot of
Vickers was the
action.
Man who was in charge of the Crown Jewels, wasn't he?
That's right. That's him. Yeah. He was also involved with fishing.
Yes.
There was a fishing issue there as well.
So there would have been, there would have been reasons, I think, for fingering him as a spy.
Yeah. He was big into fishing up around Kilmarnock.
I do a programme. I do a weekly programme on the station with Tom Toomey, and we've discussed Vickers before, and the whole shooting and things like that. There's always a larger issue, isn't it? There was.
Layers. The smaller issue with the fishing with my father, but I know he had issues with the Oath of Allegiance. Like he always followed De Valera.
Yes.
And he certainly had ideas on that, and he mentioned once or twice as well that he was kind of upset about the Catholics being sort of left on their own in the north of Ireland, but. There were issues, but the man was fishing, like, simply.
Well, the main one was his own livelihood and the livelihood of his neighbours, like, and,
yeah.
You know, to be fair, they did resolve it in the end. And they both, as you say, they both suffered dearly in order to resolve it.
Yeah, and the Limerick Board of Fishers played a big part in this as well. But they were only representing the Irish point of view. Like, there was a thing, there was this George Houston had a weir near the railway bridge and for catching eels and eels. But it was basically a blockage across the river that would be opened only occasionally. And that held up a lot of salmon.
Yes.
Because he fished in just below it, but it was full of salmon.
Of course.
And going up further up the river then towards Listowel, Greenville, there was a big weir there, Latchford's Weir. That was a building straight across the river. And that was a huge impediment to salmon trying to spawn. No, that had to be taken out of it.
Yes.
And it was. And so it was the George Houston's one. So there were all the lot of things were to be had to be sorted, and they were sorted.
As I say, that George Houston and your dad went to sort them, but they kind of suffered personally as well along the way. Like they you know.
Oh yeah.
The sorting wasn't easy. They both nearly died.
That is, absolutely. That is, and the two of them buried together.
Yeah, and so your dad, was there a long recovery process then? Obviously, he was grievously wounded. Did it take him long to recover?
I don't think he was grievously wounded, but I think it affected him mentally more than anything else.
Sure.
I think it affected him mentally. He didn't last too long afterwards.
Oh, this is Houston, yes.
Yeah.
But you're
He died in nearly 48 years of age, I think.
It's a sadness.
I think in 1937.
Sad thing. Mm. And your dad, of course, lived on to be 86.
86.
He was of hardier stock.
It is.
And did it take him long to recover from his...
less than 12 months, I believe. Less than 12 months, yeah.
Fair going.
Yeah.
And bearing less in mind that medical attention...
We had photographed him and he going around with a stick like an ass, but... No, he was back in action within 12 months again. Yeah.
He was young and robust.
Oh, he was.
You have to bear in mind as well that medical attention and medical knowledge would be maybe a lot more basic then than it was now as well.
I would say so.
But functional. But
he was young and hardy.
Yeah.
He got over it, all right. No, we often speak to my sisters and them about it. We were amazed that he had no... mental hang-ups or hangovers or at all, like, you know, because he married after a few years and had a family and became very much a family man, you know. So he got older because during the Civil War, like, he was arrested and put into Ballymullen barracks, and he described stories of fellows being taken out at random out of the cells and brought down to the bottom and being hammered and beaten.
Tortured, yeah.
He also described then being transferred to Buttevant jail and being handcuffed to the back of a crusty tender and brought down around West Cork in case there was an ambush on the Black and Tans, you know.
Yeah, collateral.
Fair play to him. He never had a... It didn't affect him.
Yeah, isn't that extraordinary? He must have been very strong-willed.
He was very much involved in family life and playing cards and drink a bottle of stout and go to football matches and have a couple of greyhounds.
He just drew a line under it and moved on. It's remarkable, isn't it?
You know, it was.
In mind, like, you know, that you wouldn't be surprised.
You'd hear of post-traumatic
stress
syndromes and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He didn't have any, far as I know.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it?
It was remarkable that he came out of it so well.
He just got on with his life and got on with his family and his business and...
Yeah.
It sorted the fishery business for himself and his neighbours and
That's right. Yeah, it did.
Oh, and, you know, fair play, because there's many people who wouldn't have been strong enough, I think, to go through all of those things.
Well, he showed fair courage and fairness to him. He did.
And did he ever talk about it or reluctantly?
Not really, not in the actual. No, funny thing, as children, our cowboys and Indian stories often referred to raids and the Black and Tans, and to be like somebody, and the hero would be someone like Dan Breen or Sean Mylan or Liam Lynch and Tom Barry, and they'd go on a raid and they'd surround the Black and Tans and they'd give the order, surrender or die. And they'd always win those battles. So that was our cowboys and Indian stories as children growing up. That's how he never really spoke seriously about it.
Yes.
It was kind of in a fun way for doing it, like.
Yeah, and did he have any long lasting health issues after it, or was
no?
He,
no? The only health issues would come up whenever he was X-rayed, because there was pieces of lead in his lungs for the rest of his life.
Of course.
And every time he went for an X-ray, there was panic stairs. Is there something wrong with his? And he told him, no, that's only lead. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
So he got no lead poisoning either.
I tell you, some man for one man.
Some man for one man.
And many of our listeners might not have heard of him unless they're familiar with the fisheries story context, you know?
Oh, no, he never went out to make himself any more popular or anything like that. No. No.
No, he just got on with it.
Got on with life, enjoyed himself. Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's a nice thing that we're here today to preserve the story, isn't it?
Well, I suppose it's positive in the main. You know, Father Brendan O'Callaghan now, who blessed the unveiling on the day, he was just saying that it was such a positive story, like a man that his life was saved and by another woman that was there saved, and then he went on and had a full and good life afterwards.
Yeah.
Because, unfortunately, too many of our heroes around that time, they were killed or they were shot, and we would put up monuments for them and that. Like, so this was
a different
angle to the story.
To put up a monument to a man who was grievously injured, but a man who had a life well lived afterwards.
That's right.
Who made a difference to his community.
Yeah, he did.
And a monument to your father, of course, is a monument to Nurse Maher as well, in a way, isn't it? Because he wouldn't have survived without her.
Mary Maher,
And it was great for
you. I met somebody in the golf course now yesterday. He was saying to me, he said, her right name is Mary Kate. He was from Dawa, this man. He said,
yes.
We know her as Mary Kate. He said, we should put in Mary Kate.
Yes.
She married a Dillon man, so Mary Kate Dillon. She was a very popular woman, seemingly, as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
she's a great woman to offer her services.
To just step in, like,
just
and
by pure coincidence.
No panic, no nothing, no.
No.
But you see,
she obviously knew what she was doing now.
And you have one chance, you know, if you have somebody with
it. Oh, I said it's only a matter of minutes.
Yeah.
I'd say he'd be gone. Yeah.
You have one chance to do it. And to be fair, she had a steady hand and a clear mind, and she just walked on in there and did it.
Extraordinary, yeah.
When the local GPs were panicking because they'd never seen
anything. Another man at the unveiling, is Paul McAuliffe, TD, Dublin North. He came down and unveiled it. Now, his grandfather was a good friend of my father's.
Oh, Josie Dan.
And so, Josie Dan McAuliffe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So they worked together.
Yes.
And Josie Dan was on the Limerick Board of Fishes with my father. So, and they were involved in giving out the licences and everything as well. So
it was a nice occasion for them all to gather together. And now, there is, I suppose, a slightly amusing bend to the end of the tale. Your father became reasonably good friends with the man who shot him.
Oh, he did. The Tralee man.
Again, another incredibly strong thing to do. Like, he didn't bear any grudge or rancour for it.
No. And fairness, I won't mention the name. Everyone knows who he's anyway. But anyway, he actually came and visited my father when he was in hospital. So he obviously...
And again, a very brave thing to
was,
do. Like,
it was,
know.
It was. Then afterwards, in the 1930s, when De Valera, when they took over the government, they gave my father an option to take up a court case against the Tralee man.
Sure.
And my father wouldn't hear of it. He said, no way in the world. He said, what happened has happened. It's in the past. And
It just goes to show, it was very strong, very robust, and very forward-thinking.
Yeah, it was.
Moving on to the next thing and the next dwelling on the past.
So it's on, the Australian man, he used to come out nearly every summer out him, and he'd be wind and dine below in the parlour, and he'd go away with a salmon or a white trout.
Yeah, there you go.
Which was good.
It is a good thing, like, because there are so many stories of bitterness and so many stories now after the Civil War.
Yeah.
Like, there would be bitterness between families in areas.
There was, but in fairness, no, that came together pretty quickly after that. Like the great Kerry football team in the early 30s, they were made up of anti-treaty and pro-treaty, like, you know.
And with the GAA, did a great job of
The Joe Barrett and Tralee and Con Brosson and my van, they played a big part in bringing both sides together, like, you know. And just, football the way together.
And just
and
saying that it's over now
which was good.
No, what a great attitude, like a great attitude to be,
it
as
was.
I say, looking for a better future rather than dwelling on the bitterness of the past.
It was, yeah. They were able to that the war situation go away, and that's it.
And bearing in mind...
Move on to the next...
That probably Kerry was one of the bitterest counties in terms of Civil War.
It was very strong, yeah. And Cork, of course, as well, the two counties, yeah. I suppose they were fairly isolated down the south, you know, they were, went down in Dublin and things, and up the north were a bit away from them, like, as regards the fishing, you know. Things like that weren't addressed by them at all.
You had the larger issue of the Civil War, and then you had the local issues, which were the bigger issues for the people who lived there, of course.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The local issues.
A livelihood and...
All politics is local, that's it.
Isn't it? Yeah, but I mean, it's a remarkable story. And I think that, they were right when they said that, a monument or a plaque for your father is a very positive one, because it's a positive story.
It is a positive story. Absolutely. Yeah.
Good came of the situation, and people found a way of resolving it. That helps the community for the future.
Yeah, it's certainly different from most of the stories, most of the monuments, and that.
Most of our monuments are for our fallen heroes and people who died much too soon.
People that were killed or shot or. Yeah.
We have a monument now for a man who was shot and survived. And finally achieved what he wanted to achieve all along.
That's right.
Fishing rights. Yeah.
And he brought a lot of the locals with him on that journey as well. Like, they all got involved in the fishing and everything. They all made money out of it. So.
That's it, a rising tide lifts all boats.
And there was good times there, I can tell you. When the fishing was, we'd say these 30 boats. My father would tell the story that some of the people would have to wait their turn to make the haul,
yes,
catch the salmon, and very often there was a half tier supporter in the bank of the river, and there was fag smoked, and they were playing cards, and pitch and toss was a very big thing that time. So there was a camaraderie went on in the bank of the river.
So there was a good amount of healing of the Civil War. It happened on the banks of the river there as well when people were fishing.
That's right. It was a big contrast from before the war. The Houstons had their fun and frolics as well in the Bank River, because my father used to tell the story that some of the gentry used to come over from London, well before the Civil War, and they'd go fishing for fun. And then there'd be lords and ladies, and they'd be walking up and down, and they'd catch the salmon, they'd be throwing them back into the river again. They were only just doing it for fun.
Doing it for fun.
That's come by train sometimes, and there was a special stop for these people near Houston's, special stop for them. They come out to train in their height of fashion, and they play horse polo and all of these games. So they had their fun and frolics before it. Now it was playing cards and pitch and toss and drinking some Guinness, things like that.
Yeah, but that just shows progress, doesn't it? When you have the lords and ladies playing polo and the local people starving for want of fish, that's not good either. That happened. Yeah, so that's the story we have for you today, the story of Mixum Costello, and it's a pretty unique story, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I suppose, it just shows that ordinary lives hide lots of secrets sometimes, don't they?
That's right.
You never know who you might meet.
No. No harm to discuss these things and make it known.
Yeah, it was the writer C.S. Lewis who said, "We meet no ordinary people in our lives. Everyone has a story."
That's right.
So I'm delighted to be joined by Tom Dillon to, I suppose, share with us the other half of the story that we began when we last spoke to Holly Costello. We began with the story of Mixum Costello and, I suppose, the personal family story. But as
as we said before we came on air, Tom, fishery disputes were nothing new by this time in 1924. They were nothing new.
Absolutely not. The River Feel was always a great salmon river, and all throughout the 19th century there were disputes between the public and, I'll say, the gentry, because rather than the landlords, because the landlords owned the fishing rights in the rivers in North Kerry, but they didn't fish.
Yes.
They leased out the fishing rights to the gentry families, like the Hewsons of Ennismore would have been one example. And there was a lot of intimidation and violence associated with the fishing cases throughout the 19th century. And one of the most famous cases actually was the Hewson family's estate at Ennismore, which would be across the river from where Mixon Costello lived in Ballyhorrigan.
Right.
But the estate would have been about 1,200 acres, and it was bounded on the north side by the River Gale, and it was bounded on the south and the west side by the River Feel. So if you think about Ennismore as well, and even the place name, Ennismore meant the Great Island.
Yeah.
And seemingly in times of flood, the rivers would flood, and so the whole identity of the area really would be tied in with the rivers. And the Hewsons anyway claimed the private fishing rights from where the two rivers joined at the kind of north western corner of their estate, all
okay.
the way around the western side and down the south side. And people, they would let people fish there if they paid them money. And now the Hewsons, remember, were paying money themselves to the owner of the fishing rights and the owner of Ennismore, who was Lord Listowel. And there'd be disputes over people fishing in that particular stretch of the river, and there were boats broken, the timber boats that people used to fish in the river, they'd be broken. And eventually, anyway, what happened was someone tried to shoot George Hewson.
Yes.
One night, this would have been in 1843, he was paying a visit to a relation on the other side of Listowel, and it was a moonlit night, he was making his way back to Ennismore, and close enough to his own house, he passed, he was travelling along the road in a horse and trap, and he passed what he thought were two women. They had shawls thrown over them. And as soon as he passed them on the road, they threw off the shawls and they levelled a gun at him and fired. But they missed. He threw himself down on the trap and the horse galloped away. But anyway, he went to get the police, and the police went across the river then to the townland of Dyshot, and they arrested a father and son, Morris and Patrick Drury. And the only evidence that they had that it was the two of them that had tried to kill George Hewson was that the paddle of the boat which they had in their house was wet. That was the only evidence, and that one of them had been heard to make threats against the Hewson family as well. They were actually convicted and transported to Van Diemen's Land, the father and the son. And years after then, the barrister in their case that defended them in court, he went on to become a judge. And it was well known now that the outcome of that court case had been a miscarriage of justice.
Sure.
But actually, the real people and their identities were known, and they're still known to this day, was not the father and son of the Drurys.
Oh, well, a wet paddle is very circumstantial. Like, that isn't really evidence.
There you go. And the miscarriage of justice anyway worked against came back really to have an influence on the fishing rights in the river, because in around 1870 then, there was another court case involving the fishing rights, and the judge in the case, who had been the barrister for the Drurys originally back 20, 30 years before, he actually ruled that there were no fishing rights from all that, about 6 miles of the river, and the Hewsons actually lost all that stretch of river then to the public fishing. And I suppose to explain the big theory behind fishing rights was that wherever a river would flow through, let's say, the countryside.
Yes.
If you want land on one side, the boundary of your land would actually be in the middle of the river, and it would be the same on the person on the other side. The boundary of the land would be in the middle of the river, and that people would own. That's where fishing rights then would be would come about. But in public water, where the river was tidal, then the public had an undeniable right to fish.
So it's like commonage.
It's something like that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Is an episcopal commonage? It exactly would be a form of that. And that would be held in trust for the public by the Crown.
Sure.
So the only way that someone could have private fishing rights in tidal waters was if a letters patent had been granted by the Crown to a particular individual. And the key thing about that then was that it had to go way, way, way back through the centuries to before Magna Carta. This is before the barons in England sat down King John and made him concede some of his royal powers. So it's going back a very, very long time.
So as we said, this event that we talk about, the shooting of Mixum Costello, it's the culmination of like 1,000 years of history now, effectively.
Centuries, yeah. Centuries, absolutely, yeah. And I mean, Mixum played a huge part in challenging the gentry's claim to private fishing rights in the tidal waters of the River Field, close to his own farm. And it was very important, Magna Carta's gone back quite a long way, you've gone back into the 1200s, and of course, those rights then would have been passed down through the different families that owned the estates and the land, and basically the landlord families of North Kerry. So on the Ennismore side, you would have had the Fitzgeralds, the Knights of Kerry. They would have been a cadet branch of the Earls of Desmond. And on the other side of the river, then, you would have had the Fitzmaurices, the Earls of Lixnair. And eventually, the rights would have come down to Lord Listowel and Lord Armitwaite. That would have been around the time 1900. So the landlords were very clever as well, that they actually even used to set up court cases, that they'd actually deliver, they'd catch people fishing in their private waters along their private stretch of the river, and they'd take them to court. And once they got a ruling from the judge to say, right, you've been poaching in this stretch of the river, they'd pay the fines themselves. So there was kind of a little bit of a game going on there, they were getting a ruling, whereas the person who was caught, it didn't cost them anything because the fine was paid for them.
Sure.
So and there was actually a famous case in 1900 where George Hewson himself, a member of the gentry, a man whose father controlled most of the river at one stage, he was actually brought up in court by Lord Listowel and Lord Armitwaite to actually get a ruling, to state that the river is private in this particular place. And that's the same stretch of river then that would have been in dispute as well in 1923-24. So it was very important, the whole point of where the river was tidal, it was judged to be the private fishing rights began at just above Mixum's farm. Actually, there's a quay in the river there, and just above the quay there was a little bit of a shallow ford across the river, and where people could go across it with horses and high-wheeled carts. And above that then was the private fishing area of George Hughes and Mrs. O'Halloran then on the Ballyhorrigan side. And that was the stretch of river then that was disputed by Mixum Costello and 11 other local fishermen as well in 1923-24. So
that's the kind of the background to the day on which we find ourselves, which is the 26th of August, wasn't it?
Yes, the 26th of August, 1923. And I suppose the big thing to point out as well was that the fishing rights were valuable. That's the important thing about it. If they weren't valuable, they wouldn't
care. People wouldn't be fighting for them. Yeah.
Yeah, they were making a lot of money out of the fishing rights. Because the salmon would come into the river at a certain time of year. Salmon, migratory fish, they come back, always come back to the river where they were born, and they'd travel up the river. And, once they'd come in down at the motor river at the Cashin, they'd be coming up along then up quite close. Then to that would be Ennismore, where the area of the river in dispute was. And Hewson was very clever, actually. He put in his fishery, in the upper section of it, he put a weir across the river, and you would always have a fish pass. That time they were known as the King's Pass or a Queen's Pass. And it would allow the salmon to jump up above over the weir and travel up river. But he had no fish pass on his weir when he built it. This would have been in 1914. So the salmon, if the water wasn't deep enough,
they were blocked at his side.
They were blocked up, and they were blocked up in his fishery. So he was very cute. He was a cute fisherman, And he'd put it at the upper part of his fishery. No, not in the lower part.
Yes.
The lower part that actually would have been in Mixum's fishery. So.
So there was a lot of kind of skullduggery and a lot of, I suppose, thinking and wheeling and dealing going on in the background of this. And I suppose we think of the intrinsic value of the fish, yes, the monetary value. But we also think of that these were people's livelihoods. These were, food, essential food for people who had very little else. I mean, Mixum, Hawley was saying that Mixum said that one of the reasons, that the main reason he became involved in the War of Independence was stories about the famine where people were starving on the banks of of a river teeming with fish, hunting for rabbits because they weren't allowed to have the fish.
Yeah, there you know, like this, the fishing
and
industry.
I suppose stories like that, it's no surprise to think of the level of bitterness and the level of passion in people's hearts regarding the fishing rights then too.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, you know, the River Feel in Cashin provided a livelihood for hundreds of families, like, and these would have been families in not very well off economic circumstances.
Families with little else, families who wouldn't have had the cattle or the pigs or the sheep, you know, to
And I mean, like, where I live close to Hawley, and there are halls, as we call them, fishing halls all along the river every so often. They all have names, and you know, they've some of them are very, very old names, like you have names like Lubeen would be one that would be very close to me. Lubeen Agay would have been the original name, the little bend of the geese. And you'd have Paul Bui would be in Hawley's, and Paul Gaurav, there was a couple of them, Krubo, Corraheen. They're all different names along the river. There was one of them actually called the Dardanelles, and there was a very interesting story about that linked to the First World War. That in 1915, Britain and France tried to invade to capture the Dardanelles Straits, which link the Black Sea to the Aegean Sea, and if they could sail the Royal Navy up through the Dardanelles Straits, they could actually capture Constantinople and knock Turkey out of the war. They couldn't get up the Dardanelles because the Turks had it in mind. They tried to capture the Gallipoli Peninsula, and they had to land soldiers on it by boat on the peninsula, and that was the first D-Day, and it's considered the first D-Day, that the soldiers had to land before dawn on the 25th of April 1915. And when they landed, they had to get into the little boats off the big, huge Navy ships. And while they rowed ashore, the Navy were firing over their heads in the dark, like, you know, and you know, all the banging and the explosions of the shells. And years after, anyway, there were fishermen in the River Feel who had been in the landings.
Oh,
and they were fishing one night, and the thunder and lightning started, and the flashing and the banging was so bad, they said it reminded them of the Dardanelles.
And ever since,
and that was where the name came from. And the name has, it's been known since, like.
But, it's fantastic.
You're talking about hundreds of salmon, like this, the river was so well stocked with fish that time, that you'd be talking about hundreds of salmon being caught in a haul. So, and George Hewson actually mentioned one time about over 400 salmon being caught in 4 hours fishing. And he made 950 pounds annually out of exporting salmon from the River Feel to places like London, Manchester, Bristol, Liverpool and Dublin. He'd send them off on the train from Dixnar Railway Station that put the fish into. There was an old man in my neighbourhood years ago, his name was Dan Mahaney, and he used to tell me as a young lad, his family worked for the Hewsons. And he remembered the last of them, which is the man involved in
George,
the fishery.
And he
said they'd catch the fish. George would fish himself in the river as well, actually, with the local men. He'd employ local men to fish with him. And they'd put the fish into the fish boxes, and they'd cover them then with felustrums, you know, like the flag iris, if you know them, that plant. And they'd cover them with the leaves of them, and they'd put them on the train then in Dixnar. And from Dixnar then they'd carry it off on the railway. And eventually they'd make their way to Billingsgate Market, was one of the famous places where they were sold in London. So it is incredible to think that they had that export link established in North Kerry, where salmon from the river would be delivered fresh to the markets over in British cities. So it was incredible. Originally, they used to actually take the fish down to Glynn. There was a family down there, Pegums, they were fish merchants. And the fish would be taken from the fisheries here in the River Feel, and from the mouth of the river down to Cashin. They'd be carried by horse and cart down to Glynn. Then they'd be taken out onto the steamers that went up and down along the Shannon Estuary. And the fish would be taken to Limerick, because the railway didn't come through North Kerry at that stage in West Limerick. From Limerick then, Waterford, and across on the cross channel steamers, and off for London as well. So it's incredible. Like, these people were just so ahead of their time, like, you know, in building railways and building these communication links, and they were so industrious.
And using the resources available to them, like, that's it.
Absolutely.
But I suppose the dispute comes about because of the lack of the willingness to share the resources with people who are less well off. You see that they're, you know, as we said before we came on, nobody really owns a river, do they?
No, that's it. Like, you know, but there was one very funny story of a local man told me about a fella who Hewson had working for him in the fishing, and they'd catch the fish and they'd make the haul and they'd catch all the fish and they'd be counting out the salmon and your men used to count them out. That's one for George and two for me, and one for George and two for me. That's the way. So even, you know, I don't know how true that is now, but I thought it was a brilliant story. And you're talking about, you know, skullduggery involved in fishing and all that. So, you know, there's an element of it, like, there's an element of it. But the fishing as well was hugely regulated at that time as well. And Hewson himself was, he was a conservator with the Limerick Regional Fisheries Board. And his father before him was as well,
yes.
Old George Hewson, as we'd refer to him. He would have owned Ballybunion at one stage, Old George Hewson. And he would have established the golf club in Ballybunion. He would have given the sandhills there for use as the golf links. And he built the Castle Hotel, which would have been the kind of the big main hotel. And many people would remember that, which was there alongside the Castle Green in Ballybunion. And he gave very generous leases to people as well.
So they were, I mean, they were, in the main part, they were good landlords. They weren't the worst of them.
Yeah, I've studied them and I've done a lot of work. Now, there are a couple of examples of evictions, but there was often reasons behind that, you know. So, like, over a period of probably 40, 50 years, I've only come across examples of three evictions.
And that's extraordinary within the context of the times. Like, you know, that they were essentially good landlords.
Absolutely. And you see, the thing about it is people think about landlords, right? But actually, there were landlords, but there were also tenants themselves.
That's
a big grey area that, no, I don't think historians actually consider that at all, or consider it enough anyway, certainly.
Yeah.
That, like, Hewsons were tenants in their home, ancestral home place of Innismore, where generations of their family lived. But then there were landlords in Ballybunion, you know?
Yeah.
And most of the people, they farm most of the land themselves, you know. So
and as you said, George fished himself. So they had a sense of the lives of the ordinary people. Like they weren't far removed from their tenants.
No, and like all, like you call them resident gentry. You
yes.
know, like there's an awful lot made of absentee landlords, right? Because they lived in,
and they didn't have any concept
no.
of how the people were living, but they lived
no.
amongst their tenants and they worked with their
yeah.
tenants.
That is, and that's it. And you see, they wanted local areas like North Kerry, West Limerick, to actually be prosperous.
Well, it suited them for them to be prosperous.
Because it benefited them as well. It benefited everyone, and that was a big philosophy actually in Hewson's dealings with his tenantry and the people that worked for him. In that, you know, his prosperity was linked to theirs. If they weren't there and available to do the work for him, let's say on his estate, saving hay and
then
crops
he'd be at loss.
He wouldn't be prosperous. So,
well, I suppose in the fishing context, a rising tide lifts all boats, doesn't it?
There you go. But an interesting thing about, he very much was involved as well, because he was a conservator. This would have been all George Hughes, you know. He was very much involved in setting a lot of the regulations as well that were involved in the river. So there's a half mile limit where two rivers meet, you're not allowed fish. And he had that put on there's actually a big, sometimes it was a kind of a girder placed on the riverbank or a concrete post that would actually mark where you couldn't fish. And then there was a very interesting one where you weren't allowed to put your net from one end of the river, one bank, let's say, across to the other and block it totally.
Okay.
No, you couldn't do that. Because otherwise the very first fisherman down at the bottom of the river, down to the mouth of the river, there'd be no fish getting up above him because they'd be all cutting his net. So they actually brought in a law where you had to leave a gap on the other side of the river. So you'd actually when you make your haul, you'd go out with your boat and you'd throw out the net, and then you'd have to curve down and turn the net in a way that you would leave a gap between.
So if some of the fish would go further up the river.
Yeah, and legally it had to be the length of an oar and the width of the boat, and that was known as the Queen's Pass. After Queen Victoria.
Okay.
And I mean, I was lucky enough to fish, like, there's no fishing in the River Field now, but about, I suppose, nearly 20 years ago, I was lucky enough to fish one summer. And the Queen's Pass is still there, and that gap is still legally required, and it's still known as the Queen's Pass. It's a relic of these 19th century fishing laws. So it's the whole thing is fascinating, you know,
yes.
And when you consider as well all the people who made money from the fishing over the years. It was so prosperous, like, in the 1960s, that fellas were leaving. Like, a lot of people emigrated to England to work. But it was so prosperous in the 1960s that you would have local men here would actually leave their jobs in England and come home to fish.
And come back.
But the fishing was actually worth more. Yeah, it was worth more to them. And I've heard stories of people buying their first car out of the fishing money, about people buying first communion clothes.
Isn't it great that eventually, yeah, at the end of all of this, all of these disputes, and as we said, the event that happened on the 26th of August 1923, which we talked about with Holly, his dad being at a rally and being literally shot point blank in the chest.
Yeah.
As a culmination of these fishing disputes. And the remarkable thing, of course, that nurse Mary Marr just reached right in and fixed him up.
I think that's one of the most incredible stories, really.
Remarkable? Like, I mean, you think of him, you imagine that him being brought to the dispensary on a door, first of all, and the doctors looking at him and thinking, oh no, this is not, he's not going to do at all. And, you know, Holly says his dad actually heard them saying that because he wasn't unconscious at all. And then up steps Mary Maher with a sound mind and a steady hand. And, she'd seen it all before.
You've seen it all before. I think it was probably the most remarkable history, really, to come out, because women are often left out of history. And I think really she's the hero she is a big hero in this whole story.
Arguably the whole thing, the whole thing got resolved because Mixum survived, and George, he and George had a sort of an agreement, to sort things out in a way that would benefit them both. But none of that would have happened without her.
No. And, the remarkable thing about all of it is, like I'd spent a lot of time researching this, the Field Fishery case, for I took part in the National Civil War Conference in UCC, and I was basing it on the Field Fishery case. But then Holly made contact with me, and he told me all the story about Nurse Mary Maher. I had never heard it. And often, this is something that exists in folklore, that people are telling the story, and folklore is often discounted as a source by historians, which I don't agree with.
Oh, no, it's vernacular knowledge.
Stuff like this.
Just because something is colloquial doesn't mean it isn't true. It just means it's remembered, it's remembered, orally rather than written down anywhere. But Mary Maher, with her quick mind and a steady hand.
Yeah, and she had been out in the First World War, out in the trenches, injuries
The poor GPs, would have seen nothing of that nature. They would have have been powerless.
Yeah, a lot of them actually, let's say around Ireland and Britain, they would have gone out there on purpose, and volunteered, because they would have gained experience of dealing with these traumatic injuries, like close-range combat and shelling and that, those kinds of stuff, shell wounds and things. But she would have seen that, and as Holly said, his father was somewhere conscious, that he could hear the doctors
saying that he was not going to live,
discussing his case, that it was all over for him, that there was nothing they could do. And then Mary Maher says, can I try, and they left her, and remarkably she saved him, so it's just incredible, and even when we had the commemoration day in Lixnaw, and we unveiled the plaque, the two families had never met. Holly's family and Nurse Mary Maher's family had never met.
And they lived quite close by.
They're quite, yeah, absolutely. And you see, the thing is, I don't know if Holly said this in his piece, but Nurse Maher went on and married a year or two after that event happened.
Yes.
And so did Mixum. So, even that alone is just remarkable, and during the event, actually, a man in the crowd actually came on, and he had a small little carved piece of stone, and it had a kind of an army badge on it, and it was engraved to Nurse Maher. And seemingly she was on the last boat to come out of Cairo during the First World War, and the soldier was meant to give her this stone. That is my understanding of the story now, and I stand corrected it as well. But he was meant to give her the stone, only he never got to give it to her. And the stone was given to the family that day as well. So
100 years later. But isn't that remarkable? And I suppose this is why we're chatting now, and this is why I was chatting with Holly, is that it is time to collect these stories before the people who remember them are gone. Somebody should have spoken with Mixum and with Mary Maher when they had a chance, and those stories aren't gathered. So we're here now, and we're picking up the pieces that are left, I suppose. That's what we're doing, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah. And do you know what I think as well about this, the whole story as well? It was the fact that Mixum and George Hewson were at loggerheads over fishing rights. There was a big court case in Dublin where they argued, either side and opposite sides. Right, and when all that was settled, the two of them could actually come together and they re-established the fish hatchery in the river field, which restocked the river, led to the prosperity of everyone. Everyone's seat was the same as the 19th century and George Hewson's father, where his prosperity was linked to everyone else's. They all worked together. And, you know, that's something that, you know, the Civil War left a long, bitter legacy after it. And here's an example of a story where people could actually put aside their differences.
A positive story from the same period.
Yeah,
because you'd see the shooting of Mixon Costello as being arguably the last shooting in the Civil War. Like, it wasn't a Civil War shooting necessarily; it was just within the period, and it was on a separate issue.
Yeah, technically it's outside the Civil War, but certainly it was involved in a big Civil War issue. Like, in our locality anyway, all through the Civil War, the fisheries were disputed.
Well,
because there was no law and order, people actually went into fish and there was no one to stop them. There was no bailiffs, there was no police, and the salmon were actually nearly fished into extinction. You know, so, like, this is underlining, like, the importance of Mixon and Hewson coming together, because
cooperation they need to restock the river before anybody can fish in it, and they realized essentially that cooperation was going to benefit everybody. The time to stop the fighting. And of course, Holly said, remarkably, Mixon lived until he was 86 and never had a bother on his health after being shot in the chest at point blank range.
It's remarkable.
And had a remarkably friendly relationship with the man who shot him.
He's
so forward thinking, I think, you know, that he just wanted to move on to better times and prosperity for everybody and not be thinking about, you know, draw a line under it.
Yeah, and like Mixon eventually would have taken over the export, right? Like, Hewson died only a few years later.
Isn't he only 48 when he died?
Yeah, he was young, like, he was
but
young.
But attempts had been made on his life, hadn't they? And he didn't recover for them in the same way that Mixon did.
No, this is the extraordinary thing about him as well, was that, you know, in 1920, he had been shot. He had rented another stretch of the fishery, the river above his fishery, and he caught people poaching there, and he challenged them. And they fired a shot, and they shot him, you know, and they left him for dead on the riverbank, and seemingly... And actually, that was mentioned in the outrages in Dublin Castle. So the police were kind of the opinion that all of these fishery disputes during the War of Independence, anyway, that side of it, that had nothing to do with politics. But
they were just a local issue, but it's hard to separate them.
I don't agree with that. No, excuse me, I don't agree with that, because there was 12 defendants in the field fishery case, and seven of them were members of the IRA at that time. And that's a fact that they're on. Actually, the IRA membership
on the register
preserved in the military archives, and also that there were medals. And then, of course, a lot of people who were active that time are not listed on the medal rolls. So that doesn't mean that there were more of them that weren't.
So the other five some of the other five could have been as well. So it can't have been a coincidence. Yeah.
No. And Hewson then he decided. I guess now he kind of. I think he figured that. You know, that the winds of change were happening, you know, and that Ireland was going to be going a different way, the 26 councils were going to be a different way. And he actually went to the Republican court in Listowel, and he brought the poachers in his fishery to law in the Republican court. So if people are not familiar with the Republican court, is that you had Dáil Éireann's, the TDs that time after the 1918 election, didn't go to Westminster because they didn't recognise the authority or the right of the British government in Ireland. So they set up Dáil Éireann, which was our own government, and then Dáil Éireann set up its own structures of law and order. You had the Republican police, you had the Republican Dáil courts as well. And Hewson now was a magistrate in the British system administered by Dublin Castle.
Yes.
And you have someone from his background
going to the Republican courts.
Going to the Republican court and looking to have them sucked out, these fellas that are coming in his stretch of river. There could again be an element of skullduggery there, like, you know. And eventually then, of course, when when the Irish Free State was founded, he needed a ruling again, and that was where the field fishery case came about, and it was heard in the High Court of Seirstadt Éire in that time in 1924, and the whole case was argued. And to prove their case that the as we mentioned earlier, the fishery was in tidal waters, so by right it should be open to the public.
Sure.
But they were claiming that it wasn't open to the public, that it was private fishing. They had to track their title then all the way back through the centuries to Magna Carta, and they needed all these historical documents to do that. And of course they couldn't do that
because they were burnt in the forecourts.
Record Office of Ireland was burned when the forecourts was bombed in the opening shots of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So again, that is an example of how the Civil War could impact on an Irish river, you know, in that sense.
While this isn't a Civil War story, it is a Civil War story. You can't separate them.
You can't. And as well, I've always said as well, it's a civil war in itself because you have neighbour fighting against neighbour.
And wasn't it Patrick Kavanagh who said all wars are local when it comes down to it?
There you go. And you see, I guess as well, it would have been a longer civil war, let's say, because it was going on a century, like we were saying. But they had a very clever solicitor as well. His name was Matthew J. Byrne, and he was a noted historian, and he was based in Listowel, originally from Cork, and he was based in Listowel, and he was able to track down all these records and where the ones there are letters exist by him to the deputy keeper in the public record office looking for such and such a grant of lands, let's say from the king or whatever, and the reply would come back then saying, you know, they've not been found or they're destroyed. And then they'd tell him, you know, these records were copied. So he was able to establish and track down copies of these records in other places. And he built the case for the landlord's title, and or not the landlord's, but the gentry's title,
yes.
And the fishery owner's title. And the ruling went their way then, like, you know, that George Hewson and Mrs. O'Halloran on the other side of the river, they were judged that the river was private along that stretch. And you see, you can imagine as well, like we were saying earlier, about how you were talking about the Civil War and the whole principles that were at stake behind it.
Yes.
Was that this oath of allegiance to the crown, that the Irish TDs would have had to swear an oath of allegiance to the British king, and the place of the crown as well in Irish government and in Ireland. That was the big dividing point. And if you think about it as well, there had to have been some element of ideals as well in these fishermen when they're challenging the gentry's title in the fishing rights, because the fishing rights had originally been granted by the English crown.
Sure.
You know, so, and they did that, through their title as Lord of Ireland, which had been given to them by the Pope before the Normans came to Ireland in the first place. So that was where, and then eventually Lord of Ireland, then the English king, English monarchs became kings of Ireland in the 1500s. So that was where all those fishing rights
it's a long story.
It's a long, long story. And you know, there's so much more like outside of what happened.
It's absolutely fascinating. Like, you know, to think of, you know, the effect that a river has on its community. You know, and that's essentially what the story is: the story of a river and the people who are living on its banks.
Yeah, and, you know? I mean, like Mixum's fishery was below Hewson's, so if he put a net across the river, no fish would have gone up to Hewson.
So it was a remarkable thing that they actually sorted it out in the end. You know, and it is a story with a largely, I know that Hewson died young, but it's a story with a happy ending for the community.
Yeah.
You know, they reached a resolution. It was satisfactory, and they both got on with things. You know, they made a success of it.
Yeah, like the hatchery in the river was there for decades after, and likewise the exportlings, and they benefited many families, my own included, you know, in the decades that followed, like families that wouldn't have had a lot of money in those lean times, like, you know. So there's a long history, like, when it comes to the fishing rights and the story in the river field. That's what kind of spurred my interest in it as well, to try and learn a bit more about it and to talk about it a bit more. But definitely, there's a long echo in history of that particular time, like, period, and those people coming together, because Mixum actually helped a lot of people as well.
Yes.
Who didn't have the money to set up as fishermen. They wouldn't have the money to buy the fishing license or the nets or the boat. He'd loan them the money, bankroll them, and when they'd catch the salmon and he'd be paying them, he'd take off so much money, he'd back so much money. That's the way it worked. That was where the hatchery worked as well. When the salmon would be sold to the fish merchants, they'd keep back so much, and that money then would go to restocking the river.
So again, a natural symbiotic relationship where everybody was benefiting everybody else.
Everybody. Yeah.
And we should say that, of course, at the end of it all, George Hewson and Mixum Costello are resting in peace together in Dysart now, aren't they?
Yeah, they're side by side. Little cemetery right in the bank of the River Feel, and it's called Dysart Cemetery, just outside Lixnaw. And George Hewson is buried there under the yew trees, and right alongside him, the next grave is Mixum Costello.
So they're resting in peace together.
Quite close to the river, yeah. So it's a lovely ending to the story, like, you know, and that the two of them could be friends, like, you know, or get on anyway, at least. Like,
making arrangements.
For the benefit of everyone.
Yeah. And Mixum lived long into old age. He lived to be 86, which is remarkable in itself.
He did. And you know, the interesting thing about it as well was when I was researching the shooting, actually, the shooting took place the day before the general election.
Yes.
And it was the 26th of August was the day of the shooting. And the people were at mass, and when they came out of mass, then the
rally was on.
The rally was on, the pro-treaty rally, and you had Finan Lynch, who was the Minister for Fisheries, was there, and he was guarded by a Free State officer. And they were heckling, and then that was how Mixum ended up being shot, like, you know. So so all of that, and then, as Hawley said, they took the door off the dispensary and brought him in on the door. So, you know, so much might have been different in terms of the fishing industry and the river if Mixum had died on the count of that. So, yeah, so he was a really important figure. And he was a fishery conservator as well himself in time, like, you know. And there was another man near Dysart, actually, Josie Dan McAuliffe, was a fishery conservator with him. So all of that would have worked into, you know, what basically was a livelihood for an awful lot of families, like, you know. So as we've said, and we put it in context, like, it was the difference between, you know, going hungry for many people.
Exactly,
like, really,
and
awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So that's our tale, a long and complex tale with a happy ending.
Absolutely, yeah, that's it, a happy ending. And we should all, you know, it's lovely to be able to look into history and find a story with a happy ending. But,
be able to, I suppose, look within our communities and see the people who live amongst us and think about their stories, because there's a lot of stories out there.
Absolutely, that's it, like, you know. And that's the beauty about local history as well. I've often think, like, that's overlooked in the bigger history, like, is that, as you say, like, people always say all politics is local. Well, all history could be local as well. And
exactly.
You know, there's gems of stories, like, as I said, Mary Maher, we've never heard of that story, like, before. And we've never heard, I didn't hear of Mixum being shot either. A lot of people, local people, didn't. And and actually the records of the time actually give a totally different name. They actually named, was it a Thomas Costello, was what the newspapers actually named. And if you look at books about Kerry in the Civil War, they actually talk about the shooting of Thomas Costello. They're completely wrong, you see. So, yeah. And I actually had to ask Hawley, like, when he came in, when I met him the first time, was it true?
Are you sure? Yeah.
He said they used to put their fist into the hole in his father's chest as children, like, you know, so.
That's a true story.
Yeah, that is a true story, so you can't argue with that. You know, so, like, as a historian, we're only ever trying to work with the records that are available.
You're dealing with truths. You're not dealing with opinions. You're dealing with truths and facts. And when a man can tell you that you know, he has literally seen the wound, put his hand into it, then you know it's the truth.
Yeah.
Great story.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a huge tradition of fishing in the rivers in North Kerry and in the River Feel. And, you know, it's a shame now that the fishing industry doesn't fish anymore, because the fish docks in the river's been closed. And,
it's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a shame, because it really is, you know, it's something that's unique to North Kerry, you know, and in many, many aspects of it, you know. And, like, I've tried to collect the names of the fishing halls along the river, because there's an older generation who know them. And sadly, the younger generations, they're not going to have that relationship with the river, like these people who spend
They lived on it and in it and with it. And they knew every inch of it and knew what was happening, you know, you know, by just a glance. But
And to hear them talking about the fishing and it's particular times of year when the white trout would come, or when the fellestrums would be in flower, the flag irises would be in flower, and they'd know when the salmon would be coming in the river, and then the pail were the a certain size of salmon, they'd come at a certain time as well. And to hear them talk about it, you know, like, really they have a relationship with the countryside and the landscape that people of my generation generally don't, sadly don't, you know. It's a shame, but like, it should really be treasured and and research more. I mean, I'd love to do more research about it. And even the fishing boats in the river field as well had a particular design to them, you know. And
unique to the locality,
Yeah, as much as the Navy Oak was native to West Kerry and the other places, you know, the fishing boats in the field had their own particular design as well, which made them usable in the conditions and the environment where they were. Like, you couldn't have a hide boat there because there were so many roots of trees and rocks that they'd be getting hold all the time. So, yeah, so the skills that were there and the way they made the nets as well, they handmade the nets.
All of these skills, of course, gone.
Yeah, and you'd hear people talking as well about when they'd have the stations in the locality years ago, the priests would go down to the bank of the river and bless the boats as well. So you'd all those kinds of things.
Well, the boats were life. The river was life, you know. If you didn't bless that, you weren't blessing any source of life and livelihood. Tom, it has been sensational to talk to you about the fisheries case. And even though we brought it back to the Magna Carta, we're still only scratching the surface of it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a big, big story, you know. So, a lot more. I've a lot more research to do as well. Like, but you know, it's the field fishery case, Mixon Costello, Nurse Maher, you know, George Hewson. They're just fascinating characters, you know. And it's been brilliant to bring that much of it anyway to light and be able to write and talk about that as well. Like, so honestly,
and bring it back to its people, you know, to have the people of the locality, the people here of the West Limerick area and beyond, to be able to hear this story and to be able to know it and remember it and access it. Like, that is a valuable thing in and of itself.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. It's been a pleasure talking anyway, so thanks, Charlotte.
My heart tonight is lonely for my sire land. Though many miles of ocean lie between, my heart tonight is home again in Ireland, with many a smiling Buccleuch Colleen. Ah, would that in that green isle or the billows one hour of you a roving lad might steal, to stand again entranced beside the willows. Upon thy banks my silver river feel. I've had success, or so the world reckons. I've everything I've wished for at my hand. Yet o'er the sea an Irish river beckons, and how can I deny its clear command? For what are riches when the heart is aching? Or what is wealth when all my senses steal? To stand again and watch the red dawn breaking above thy banks, my silver river free. I mind me when I walk the summer meadows, beside my Nora of the flowing hair, her features touched by many hazel shadows, showed loveliness and gentleness and care. Oh, lovely river filled with salmon over, how oft to you in lonely dreams I speak, to where she parted from her foolish lover. Upon thy banks my silver river flew. night I see a cottage fire a-gleaming. The elves are dancing round the fairy ring, while up a stream comes silver salmon teeming, alive with all the urgencies of spring. And when the great God thinks it's time for homing, perhaps he'll let my weary spirit steal, linger for one moment in the gloaming. Upon thy banks, my silver river
Sincere thanks to Holly Costello and to Tom Dillon for taking the time to share their memories and their research with me and making it possible for me to create this programme today. Thank you too to you, the listeners. Without you, I would not be here still creating programmes, and I hopefully you have enjoyed today's programme, and I will speak to you next time. Bye-bye for now.